Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. My name is Jake Entwistle, your host for today, and joining me to talk about the European finals and looking ahead to a summer packed of even more football is, first of all, chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Welcome to the European Review special.
Let's talk about six, baby.
Oh, he stole. He didn't take him long, did he, to steal?
Oh, that was sly, man.
We'd planned the whole intro before the podcast, and Mo's taking it off me. But oh well, welcome on. You've now got some serious reputation to live up to now.
Well, you know, I mean, I froze and I was like, what can I say? More takes. I'll just say that.
Also joining me is chief editor at Squawker, Will Hall. How are you, Will?
I'm good.
I bet you're definitely up for talking about six,
really,
baby.
Happy, yeah.
I can imagine you would have loved all of those Klopp videos coming out of him on the bus.
It was a mixture of, sort of enjoyment. But also, did you see the one at the end where... Well, firstly, he tipped beer over Ruin Brewster's head. And I had to Google Ruin Brewster's age.
Yeah.
So quickly to check whether he'd not done something illegal. And then there's one where he's... It looks like he could have fallen off the bus right at the back because it sort of starts abruptly and he's like, he jolts back and forward.
And then he sort of jokes around like, oh, maybe I can fall off. Maybe I'll go off. It's like,
surrounded by his players who look genuinely concerned as well.
Exactly.
So I found them enjoyable, but I also found them slightly worrying.
Hold on, but I think it was just sort of the release of that whole emotion. Obviously, first European Cup for him. I was really happy to see him, and I genuinely just thought, I've not seen a manager look happier after winning a title.
Yeah, he really loved it.
But before that, Sam, listening to Jurgen Klopp, so I had to dwell there to get Will's opinion on that. Rich content editor at Squawker, Sam Long, is on the pod. How are you, Sam?
I'm very well, thank you. I think standout moment from the parade was Wijnaldum dropping his phone.
Yeah, I was going to say, if Klopp didn't fall off, Wijnaldum's phone certainly did. Now I can't even segue nicely into the final because Mo stole it. So we are going to talk about six. I won't say baby because Mo said it. The final itself, though, just a quick bit on the match before we delve into what this means for the future of Liverpool Football Club. It wasn't a brilliant affair. And Trent Alexander-Arnold even said that Liverpool were shocking afterwards. So why do you think it was... a drab, especially the first half, was pretty poor. Obviously, apart from the second fastest goal in Champions League history, not much quality on show.
Yeah, the one key reason is the Moussa Sissoko handball, of course, that results in a legitimate penalty, but one given for technical reasons rather than an offence that actually gained Spurs an advantage. And I think that's part of the reason why that's triggered the most sort of emotional response in terms of disappointment among neutrals and Spurs fans as well. But the particular type of bad football that ruined the final was evident even in the build-up to that penalty, really, in which we got poor passing up until Fabinho's like clipped pass out to the left wing that gets Mane in the position to win the penalty. Beyond that, though, poor passing, and we saw the ball spend Sunday league levels of time in the air. And in fact, that is a pattern that played out across the whole of the game. Because during the entire 125-game Champions League season, only 10 games have seen more headed clearances than the Champions League final, which had 28. And only three fixtures recorded a lower combined pass accuracy, which was 74.5%. Obviously, much was made about Liverpool's pass accuracy overall, which is in the 60s, I believe. But I think what explains this essentially is the physical and mental conditions which fill in the rest of the picture. It's the fact that it's two English teams playing in high temperatures 3 weeks after their previous competitive game. And 3 weeks stewing in like the psychological torture of anticipation.
I thought you just meant the Madrid heat.
I think Liverpool was Marbella, wasn't it? But all of these factors were mentioned by Klopp in his press conference after the game, during which he also more or less admitted that of the four finals he's overseen at Liverpool, this was the worst performance. And as he said up top, Trent Alexander said they were shocking as well. But how they actually won it, I think, does relate to how Klopp, over the course of this season, in some ways made Liverpool worse in order to make them more successful. because this final was one of only four Champions League games in Klopp's entire time at Liverpool in which they failed to create a big chance. So that's over two seasons. Mm. What Opta define as a big chance, which is a situation where the striker is expected to score, usually a one-on-one or a tap-in.
Yeah. Penalties are also big chances, but obviously you can't create a penalty.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Mane did his best.
Well, exactly. And then a lot of people making the point that that is going to... You might see a trend follow next season where players are sort of practising this in training, like kicking the ball
actively
into the defenders.
Doing it, yeah. Well, I mean, if you see on the continent, just say, you see this on the continent a lot with defenders, when they're running out to a winger, they run out with their hands behind their back. Barcelona players do it a lot. Alvaro did it later in the game and they were like, oh, and Glenn Hoddle was complaining that you can't set yourself. But defenders have been doing this for a while on the continent because if you have your hands out and the ball hits your hands on the continent and in Europe now as well, that is a handball. Like, even if it's like your hand is clearly by your side and you're not doing it.
I always say about, I sort of draw the parallel with hockey, and I know we've spoken about this before in the office, Sam, about how I sort of align myself with, like, to make the handball the simplest it can be and avoid all of the sort of not unnecessary, but incessant debate about every decision that goes. Just when it does hit your hand, if you get just like an indirect free kick rather than a penalty, and it could still be in the box, but you just be like, if it hits your hand, you're not gaining that complete, oh, we scored the second fastest goal in Champions League history. But say that was done and Mane hits his hand and Liverpool get a little indirect free kick, you're still in a very good position and it almost becomes like a penalty corner, a short corner in hockey, where if it touches your foot, the possession's turned over.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how it happens. So I think there's room there for...
It'd be quite radical, I think.
But it would be radical,
It certainly is becoming an issue, especially with VAR, because that sort of throws open the grey area. But to come back to like how this game sort of illustrates, despite being a poor performance by the words of two of the actors in the poor performance, Klopp and Trent Alexander-Arnold, but despite it being a poor performance, how this sort of reflects the success of this season generally and how Klopp's managed to orchestrate it is, I think, reflective of something that we've discussed all season. It's essentially the shift of the creative burden from Philippe Coutinho in midfield to the two fullbacks, Trent Alexander-Arnold and Robertson. The byproduct has obviously been a more conservative side because you're reserving your sort of vertical passes and your dribbles forward for the flanks, which is a safer area to do those kind of acts than the middle of the pitch where you can get cut off and then hit on the break.
Just lumping it to Mane.
Yeah, and also, we have seen quite a few more long balls, and we've spoken as well about how Trent Alexander-Arnold and Van Dijk are two of the best long ball passes in the Premier League, well, certainly in my opinion. But... So the answer to how Klopp now takes this forward and tries to sort of redress that balance that he's swung to in a certain way ties in without compromising the newfound defensive quality as well, ties in with what Arsene Wenger said at the end of the game when he said Liverpool could dominate Europe by improving their technical ability. But in doing so, they may diminish the fighting spirit that has served them so well this season in the process. And I think Klopp may already have the answer, who is a player I'll come on to later when we change subjects, because we're obviously focusing on the game a bit more now.
Than I promised. But just that sort of Liverpool analysis, obviously, the one stat that sort of speaks to what you're saying is Joel Matip made 14 clearances in that game, which is massive.
Yeah, and I also would say that the other thing that underlines the sort of importance of those two fullbacks is that after the penalty, Liverpool only really had two big chances in that half, both of which were shots from outside of the box from Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold that had pretty much been created by themselves, just running past.
Rampaging
down
forward.
The channel, yeah.
I mean, ultimately, I think the match was the way it was. Obviously, as Will says, there are tactical factors where Liverpool play, but they scored early. They scored very early, and this season they've been a side that's predicated themselves on the defence. So they were like, okay, we've got a goal, break us down. They effectively did what Barcelona tried to do to them, except they actually held their nerve, whereas Barcelona collapsed at Anfield trying to hold it on to the lead. Liverpool held on to their lead. Very excellent from Matip, excellent from Van Dijk. Alisson was very good as well.
Well, the Alisson, that was one I was going to introduce as well, just to butt in case anyone didn't see it. Alisson's eight saves, which obviously you get the narrative, oh, they were straight at him, but they're straight at him because his positioning's so good.
Like Klopp said post-match, he makes the difficult things look easy. Exactly. He made it look very easy.
And I think the fact that Alisson, every shot feels like it's straight at Alisson, is actually the best explanation for how good he is as a goalkeeper. 100%. Those 8 saves, Opta emailed Opta during the game and said, how many, is that the best? And Edwin van der Sar made 8 also, but he conceded 3 goals. So Alisson has made the most saves in a Champions League final since 03-04 whilst keeping a clean sheet and in a Champions League final.
He was really good. Liverpool built bet on their defence, essentially, and it worked. And they said, go on, Spurs, break us down. They've got, as Will hinted at, they've got a very workmanlike midfield because, of course, they've got their fullbacks and their creators. So it was just like, come on, Spurs, have a go. And, you know, Spurs were game-ish to a degree. They tried, but they didn't really. In the first half, they just looked like they had no idea what they were doing. They were panicked, they were worried. Second half, they actually created some good chances, But they faded badly for a little bit in the middle of the second half, and they just didn't have that execution. It looked very much like Spurs were acutely aware this was the club's first ever Champions League final. They looked like they were definitely playing with pressure, whereas Liverpool, they didn't look comfortable per se, but they looked like they knew what they were doing.
They very much had the redemption.
Yeah, you could tell they'd been there, basically. Yeah. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, no one in Liverpool, you looked like they were panicking. They've been here before. Spurs looked like they were like, oh my God, it's the Champions League final. Because players who don't take bad touches were taking bad touches. Son had a couple of really, really bad touches when running through on goal. Dele was just like non-existent. Eriksen was good. Eriksen had a couple of really nice passes, but
Dele nearly got the Sam Long prediction header, didn't he?
I know, peeled away, didn't he?
It was right there.
A shout on that, we all did quite poorly.
I think my general prediction that it was going to be a poor game.
But one person we spoke about obviously beforehand, and the big decision that's dominated the headlines, Harry Kane, and you're saying that Liverpool were trying to do what Barcelona did. They didn't have to face an unfit Harry Kane.
Yeah,
well, no, sort of tongue in cheek, but that's sort of been the top. That's sort of been the talk. Is it like, why did Harry Kane start? 11 touches in the first half, which was the fewest on the pitch. But at the other end, Firmino didn't have many at all, and Wijnaldum, who in the semi-final came on to score 2 goals against Barcelona and said, I was angry that Klopp didn't start me, proved why Klopp was right, I thought. I didn't think he was that impressive in midfield, and obviously got taken off anyway for the Ribena drinking James Milner. But on Harry Kane, Sam, obviously Pochettino predicted that he was going to get hammered for it and said, you'll murder me if it goes wrong. And you could argue it went wrong in terms of result, but did he make the right decision in starting Harry Kane? And was it Kane that was bad, or was that sort of a product of the, as we've said, the game itself?
I think it was definitely the right call to start him. And if Pochettino had the choice again, even with hindsight, I would say nine times out of 10, he would make the same call. Poch's time at Spurs has shown us that even when Kane is not quite fully fit, he will start him. They've worked together long enough to know that even if he isn't quite 100%, that it's a calculated risk that they're willing to take.
He's better than Llorente.
Yeah. I mean, it deserves to be questioned now that Spurs have lost the game and Kane looked jaded and not quite there. But I think it would have been a bigger regret to leave him on the bench and think what could have been if everything had gone right for Spurs in the game. So it was pretty obvious that he was sort of on the pitch to be there if that one golden opportunity presented itself. And if that opportunity had come for Spurs and he wasn't on the pitch, then I think that would have been, everyone would have been going full pelters at Pochettino.
Yeah, exactly. Kane having 11 touches isn't necessarily mean he is bad. As I said there, Firmino didn't get much service because of the tactical ploy you mentioned there, Will, about aiming it more towards the flanks. Firmino's there as a disruptor, unleash Mane, unleash Salah sort of thing. So Firmino didn't have many touches, and it was the lack of quality in midfield. Mo, you mentioned the poor touches of the likes of Dele, who is there as we saw flicking it around the corner usually.
Yeah.
Meant that Kane, he wasn't great, but did he have much service?
I thought starting Kane was the right move, like Sam said. I think because for two reasons. One is he's not only is he obviously your best striker and he has an innate finishing ability. So, you get a half chance, like I said, you want to fall to Harry Kane, right? You don't want Dele or Llorente on the end of it, even though they're good. Kane is different level. The other thing is, I think tactically, starting Kane, he basically withdrew him as a deep four because he was like, he's not going to be able to make runs in behind at all. And it was, they were playing balls into him and they were running Sun off him, running Dele off him. And it kind of worked. I mean, it's not Kane's fault necessarily that Sun and Dele were so outrageously bad. He gave that he helped participate in some attacks. He wasn't great and he faded hugely. Where I think Poch made a mistake was he didn't take him off. I think that was the mistake. I think, look, you start Kane, you have to gamble on your best player, right? And he worked to a degree. He was participating in the way the way Spurs were playing. They were linking off him. He was moving into spaces to create spaces for other players, and it was working. They were creating chances, half chances, at least chances to run at the Liverpool defence. They didn't really do anything with Son. Had that one shot off of Eriksen's amazing pass, which was part possible because Kane had pulled the defence in a certain direction. But then you take him off because the second half he was clearly, he wasn't even doing that anymore. He was just sort of standing around. And like you said, then it was just like they're just hoping that the ball falls to him in the box and he can shoot. And that's not viable when you have to break Liverpool down. You need more movement, you need more dynamism. And what Poch did was, obviously he brought on Lucas Moura. Okay, fine. But he took off Harry Winks and he took off Moussa Sissoko, who were Spurs' best players. I mean, I know Moussa Sissoko got away the penalty, but they were the best performers. They were the ones driving through midfield, keeping Liverpool from really getting any sort of foothold in the game and just resorting to basically punting it along to the forwards. And I think by taking them off, especially Winks, who I thought was the only Spurs player who looked capable of passing the ball with any sort of assurance, he made it so that, okay, fine, maybe if Spurs get the ball into the box and have a shot, they can do something. But it was much harder for Spurs to get the ball into the box. They had like a brief run between like 70 and 80 minutes, I think it was, where they had like two or three chances of thinking, oh, okay, they're going to do something. But, you know, it's hard to get the ball to Kane to shoot when you've taken off your two best midfielders. And I thought that's Poch's, not starting. I thought starting Kane, you make sense. You do that. You take that risk. But you got to take him off.
Yeah,
you got to take him off, and it just didn't do it.
Perhaps holding on to the hope that he would just have one of those 40-yard absolute.
Yeah, it's the idea that the ball's fallen off his head. Oh, it's 20 yards out. Because Kane can score from that situation.
So. But it ended up being Divock Origi who got the final say in the final. Obviously, all of his goals in Europe for Liverpool have come in the semi-final or final. 3 shots in the Champions League this season. 3 goals. The hero. And he secured number 6 for Liverpool. And obviously, only Real Madrid and AC Milan have more European Cups now. Will, you mentioned there Wenger saying that this is a chance for Klopp to dominate Europe. He said he spoke to Pep straight on the phone afterwards.
Yeah.
We're going to be taking this next level next season.
It was a weird joke. It was about a physio that they've poached from.
Oh, yeah, they also said that. But he was talking about the actual phone call with Pep and saying that like we're going to kick each other's butts next season.
Yeah.
We had a listener's question from Junaid Sharma who said, "In an era of is this an era of dominance for Klopp's Liverpool beginning now?" He's laid down the markers, as I said, after post-match that suggests he wants it to be that way. But how does he take Liverpool from 97-point runners-up into treble, quadruple, quintuple winners? Because obviously they've got plenty of trophies on offer already next season.
It boils down to the dilemma I mentioned earlier. And obviously it's very hard to improve on the 97 points. And they could probably still win the title and record a lower points tally last season, but it boils down to this dilemma of how we can sort of reintroduce some of the creativity we saw in the sort of season before this one just passed in the middle of the pitch without compromising the defense that's basically been their sort of standout feature this season, in which we've seen a bit of a more subdued front three.
Yeah. Well, they became the first trio last season to score 10 goals each in the Champions League, but didn't win. This season, 5 for Salah, 4 for Firmino, 4 for Mane, but they got a trophy.
Yeah.
So.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is what I was saying earlier. Like, Klopp's made them worse, and it's made them more successful. It's resulted in him answering the main criticism of him, which is lack of silverware. So the answer of how you reintroduce the technical quality that Wenger pointed out. Admittedly, after a game in which technical quality was scarce and way below Liverpool's usual standards, even if they're not quite the technicians that Man City
are. You trying to downplay Arsene Wenger's ability to perfectly analyse a game there?
Well yeah, I'm accusing him of recency bias, basically. But I think the answer for Liverpool exists not really necessarily in buying a new major signing in the middle of the pitch. And Klopp's, in fact, downplayed the chances of that happening. But the answer is either Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, who we know a lot about, obviously he's played in this country for a while. We know how he can dribble in tight spaces in the middle of the pitch, and he's also quite good in terms of chances created and passes. He's always scored by Arsene Wenger as well. Wenger. So there we go.
That's what Arsene Wenger was talking about.
That would be Wenger's advice. But the most interesting candidate, I think, is Naby Keita, who, while at Leipzig, was identified as a player. There was this website called Played Off the Park, and they released a graph that basically records vertical passes in terms of accuracy and a player's sort of propensity to attempt more output of them. And Keita was sort of highlighted as one of the strongest outliers in both of these metrics in terms of European-based midfielders under the age of 24. So in short, I mean, he has the mindset to make those aggressive game-breaking passes and the technical ability that Wenger mentions to execute them. And how Klopp goes about getting the best out of Keita without ruining everything he's done this season in terms of operating through the flanks, through the safer areas, is of way beyond my pay grade. And reportedly, if Klopp does it, well, while doing it, he'll be on a new contract worth £10 million a season. Mm. Which, if you believe the figures that France Football reported in April, when they listed the top 20 best paid managers in Europe, actually represents a pay cut. About 1.2 million. So, I mean, we'll just see how that one plays out.
Stop winning trophies, Jürgen. Yeah.
So a pay cut after the Champions League is what awaits Klopp. Yeah. But so he's got to figure that out.
He's got to figure out how to get some money.
Yeah.
Get paid.
But if I was being ruthless and stepping away from the tactical conundrum he's got to solve, if I was being ruthless and being greedy, I'd sign Adrian Rabiot for free. Tell Milner that we might just have to look at you now as a backup left-back option.
Oof, brutal.
Harsh.
Or else you're going to have to go out and sign someone to replace Alberto Moreno, which they should maybe do anyway.
Yeah.
And because Milner's 1 year left on his deal, I think, and linked with PSG, so I think...
Swap.
I don't think they're going to be able to depend on him for too much longer, even if he's playing as well as he's...
Man, Milner will get La Liga with that command of Spanish that he has.
Yeah, that's another option. I mean, the world is his oyster.
Go play next to Santa Cazorla for Villarreal, mate.
Oh, imagine that.
But the most ruthless thing I'd maybe do is I'd choose not to bank on Divock Origi's big game super sub impact continuing, and I'd make a big signing to replace Daniel Sturridge and rival Roberto Firmino, who's been the most sketchy member.
Sturridge, the lucky charm.
Based on this season's form. Yeah, well, him and Moreno are pretty much the guys that are just confirmed to be off in summer.
Daniel Sturridge became the first player to win the Champions League with two different English sides in and the Champions League era, but didn't make an appearance in either final.
But he made a contribution earlier on in the season when he scored against Paris Saint-Germain.
He's saying a striker, though. What about Rian Brewster?
Yeah, so that's the other option to promote from within.
I mean, because he's, you know... Be it soaked or not, you know, he's pretty special, isn't he? So it's like
dripping in potential as well as
I think everyone wants to see what quite a few Liverpool fans would like to see is like that elite mentality of like never standing still and returning.
Yeah, and like, but then imagine promoting. Look at Trent.
But yeah, true.
Look what happened with him, right? Yeah. Back. Youngest player to start back-to-back Champions League finals.
Yeah,
look at his stats in the Champions League. He was leading everything. And he's 20 years old. So who's to say that?
Give
Ian
the
Brewster,
kids a chance, man. Give
exactly.
The kids a chance.
He'll also give you the moral high ground over Man City. Yeah. Even if you've just spent the whole of the Coutinho money on two players.
No.
Hey, there was a photo actually of the two of them celebrating. It's like 142 million. Minus one Coutinho plus these two. Money well spent. You're like, can't argue with that.
No goals conceded for Alisson. No dribbled past for Van Dijk. Still, Mikel Merino, the last player to do that, Sam reminding us before. Someone sign him. That's the way to beat Liverpool. Get the old Newcastle's midfielder in. But a midfielder, actually, from La Liga as well, that we had another listener's question just on Spurs, and this will be the last point on the Champions League final and the two teams involved in that, from Kung Fu Kenny at Joshua CM. Is Spurs paying 60 million for Giovanni Lo Celso worth it? Because remember, they didn't make a signing, and he was the one that there were quite a lot of reports about.
Yeah.
£52 million bid, but it's an £88 million release clause. And I know you're penchant for La Liga football, and he's been great in for Real Betis. Obviously, signed permanently from PSG after the loan, but it looks like a similar situation to Jovic and Frankfurt in the sense that, yeah, we'll get them for 20 million, but we know that...
Well, they can definitely sell him for a lot. He's really, really good. If you watched... I mean, there's a reason PSG got him in the first place. That they thought he was going to be the business, and then they never played him for various reasons, mainly because PSG are weird. But he's he was excellent for Betis. Really, really, and Betis were a really oddball side. So, I mean, his stats aren't necessarily great. 9 goals, 4 assists. Not going to blow you away, but that's because Betis themselves were kind of up and down under Quique Setién this year. But he's really, really good. He's really, really great to watch. He's a great dribbler, good balance. Another Argentine lefty, inside forward type. You know, they make those guys on trees down there, I think. And he's got good pace. He's got a good shot on him, good goal scoring ability. I think 60 million seems like a lot, but honestly, I mean, he's very young and he's exactly what Spurs need, I think, really.
Yeah. Well, could that, the second bolt on of that question was, could it propel them to a title challenge next season, or are they still way off Man City?
They're so far off because it's not just that their first 11 isn't up to the same standard as City is. I mean, who are their two midfielders? Do they know? Is it Winks? Can he stay fit? Mm. Who would play next to Winks? Is it Sissoko? Does he play further forward? They don't have a defined system. Poch is still too reactive for me to mount a serious title challenge. He's great in cups, though. If he actually focused on them, he could start doing a cup, being a cup team again.
It's almost like with those Liverpool and Man City accumulating that many points, why don't you just be like, right, while we build the squad, why don't I actually just say top four and then get those trophies in? You could almost change tact because, as you said, the Premier League challenge looks so far off. And as well, Lo Celso might not be enough to make them challenge Liverpool, but it might be enough to keep them above the Europa League finalists. Chelsea and Arsenal, obviously... It was a long time ago now. Chelsea, Eden Hazard turning up. Again, I got half of my prediction right in the sense that he'd score. But didn't break the tape.
I was let down by probably the most lenient ref ever. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that Socrates stamped on, was it Giroud in the first hit? Didn't even get a yellow. Yeah.
So again, we turned into actual football managers.
Blaming
referees on our predictions not coming true. But just a point on that, Mauricio Sarri getting his... Well, Klopp got his first European trophy after 3 finals and 4 finals with Liverpool. Sarri gets his first trophy ever.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure, although I did see some people reporting that in Serie D he got some sort of trophy, but I don't think that counts as a major, really, when it's the fourth tier. But now, he could be winning that and going straight to Juventus, where you're pretty much expected to get a trophy. Do you think... it's been an odd season for Chelsea. Do you think he was treated unfairly, and who do Chelsea look to if he does go to Juventus? Frank Lampard?
First of all, with Sarri, I think he's definitely been treated a bit unfairly. We've talked about it before. He sort of felt like a dead man walking for half the season, really. And he's got every right to sort of finish the season with a top four finish, Europa League trophy, and sort of say, two fingers, I'm off if you're not sort of happy with my work. I think it's a reminder of how cutthroat football can be. The shot of him looking at his medal after the Europa League final, it was hard to sort of not feel sorry for him considering how tough he's had it.
Yeah.
In terms of people coming in, I would like to see Lampard get it.
It's a bit soon, isn't
it? It is too soon. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily the right option for Chelsea, but I would love to see that happen.
I want them to explode.
Under Abramovich, they've sort of lurched from one philosophy to the other, but still managed to keep going sort of through the chaos somehow.
Churning which is those a sort trophies
of,
out.
Yeah, a skill in itself. But it would be amazing to see Frank and Jody Morris, of course, come in and give an opportunity to put their stamp on a club that they obviously know really well. Jake, you know that they've got loads of players in that academy that we'd like to see.
Well, Jody Morris as well, you've mentioned there, knows them. He won a treble with them. So... be a bit difficult to sort of turn that into the Champions League.
Of course. So appointing Lampard, obviously, it feels a bit more like a project rather than a finished product. And obviously, Chelsea need the latter. They can't really afford to have a season of progress but not results because they demand, their demands are so high.
It'd be amazing if they changed philosophy, though, like because they've always talked about like they want to be this club and then they just end up being cutthroat, like Real Madrid. But it'd be amazing if they actually... because like Morris works with all those kids. They've got so many talented youngsters that are out on loan. They can bring them all back. Like a transfer ban, no problem. We'll play the kids. Mm. You know,
the Juventus offer to Sarri, yeah. The reported Juventus offer, because does I think deny us the chance to really see whether Chelsea were sincere in their pivot from this sort of win at all costs blueprint set by Mourinho in his first season and what Mourinho is really all about, yeah. and we're turning towards the sort of more project manager style, which we don't really know because maybe they would have kept him.
That's what I mean. They can say, he was going to be here for years. Yeah. But you can't turn down Juventus.
It's interesting with Allegri, though, because essentially they could be swapping clubs for many millions in conversations.
And as well, they've finally paid Conte and he's back in Serie A. We spoke about him. So Sarri, Conte will be a nice little battle of the Chelsea managers in Serie A.
It'll be very interesting to watch, just briefly on Juventus, it'd be very interesting if Sarri does get their job, because that's an old squad that is not suited to play his kind of football at all. They would need a lot of work to get to play Sarri's mode.
And if he struggled with Kepa not being willing to sub off, there some pretty high profile players in that Juventus squad. Let's just leave it at that. Hopping over to North London, or back to North London, as we spoke about Spurs, Unai Emery loses his first Europa League final. The Unai Emery League is no more. The main talking point seems to be that after a decent first half, again, the game in Baku wasn't great, and the organisation of it at Central sort of was the final it deserved. But they were on top in the first half, potentially. But despite me saying that Aubameyang was finally going to put away one of those chances, he decided not to be able to kick the ball properly. Lacazette had a poor game by his high standards set this season, but obviously Mesut Ozil has been put under the spotlight mainly by Idrissa Johnson, who said that he should have been embarrassed after that performance and embarrassed by being substituted and walking off when being down, and obviously there's reports that there's been a bit of tension between Emery and Ozil because of that decision. It looks now that the only choice now is to move on from Ozil at Arsenal. How do they do that? I mean, is the question.
There was always the hope that you could integrate Ozil into the way Unai Emery plays football, because Ozil is such a fabulous footballer, right? Mm. And on the final, just briefly on the final, I think Arsenal actually lacked Mkhitaryan to come off the bench and give them an extra bit of space. So the political ramifications of him not going there actually had footballing consequences.
Yeah, but potentially. I don't think Mkhitaryan is going for pace.
It was 4-1, but I mean, I just think it was a part of the second half. I was thinking, if they could bring on Mkhitaryan here...
Wobi was the best player.
I mean,
and he came up. He was very good at Wobi.
So, but anyway, back to this. It was... they've got to get rid of him, right? Because it's clear that as good as he is, and he is still very good. Let's not pretend that he isn't, or forget that he isn't, because he walks around the pitch sulking sometimes. He's very good, but it's the way Emery wants to envisage Arsenal playing football. He doesn't fit into that.
No,
essentially. And it's not that he couldn't fit into any modern team. It's just that he is the very specific old school kind of creative number 10 who needs the team to be built around. That means he needs legs in midfield behind him, but players who can pass the ball forward, and he needs runners in front of him. And it's not just that, because he has that at Arsenal. He needs the team to then go through him constantly. Whereas with Arsenal, with Emery, it's obviously more about the fullbacks. Mm. It's bringing it out wide, it's overlaps, and it's the fast forwards. What he needs is a team that's going to say, okay, everything goes through Ozil. In the same sort of way that everything at Atletico Madrid goes through Griezmann, everything at Barcelona goes through Messi. He needs that sort of role. So maybe Atletico Madrid, frankly, is a good option. Although they're probably looking at Dybala, I heard, or João Felix.
Well, if anyone's going to get Ozil to run around, Simeone.
But that would be it. Like, that's the kind of position that he needs. It's not that he needs to be a luxury player. He needs to be the focal player. Yeah. And I think even now at Arsenal, he isn't that. There were moments under Wenger where he was that. And I think he shone greatly.
19 assists.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, would have smashed the record if Giroud hadn't forgotten how to score the second half of that season. So it was, you know...
Remembered in the Europa League final, didn't he?
Yeah, he remembered just in time for Chelsea. By the way, that's so weird, watching Chelsea's Olivier Giroud score past Arsenal's Petr Cech. It was just weird. It was really weird. But anyway, look, Ozil's fantastic. I don't know where he's going to go, but I hope where he goes is... there's only so many clubs that can afford his wages, so I think Arsenal are going to be on the hook for at least paying half of what he earns anyway, even if they can't move him off to a super club. I don't know a super club that would take him.
No.
Yeah, I can't see him being a focal point of a big club.
Turkish clubs seem like the best bet for him purely because they have a lot of money and it's like they would give him the focal point that he deserves, and he would be adored there as well.
If you look at what has happened to James Rodriguez at Bayern as well, it's like he's come in and taken some games by storm, scored hat-tricks, was really good actually last season. This season, you can't fit him in.
Same sort of thing, isn't it?
This is what I mean, is that we're talking about these fullbacks becoming the main creators, and there's no space in that middle of the pitch anymore because everyone's so fit, everyone's so fast that you can't necessarily dictate from there. You need to play in safe areas more often than you usually would. And people like Ozil, again, when you're Emery's system as well, and Emery deserves some criticism, but also the tools he's working with. He's tried to find it, that 3-5-2 or 3-4-1-2 was the best of what he could do with those players, but it wasn't actually that perfect because he wants to play on the front foot. But even Wenger was saying when you play with the back three, you can't play on the front foot. So Emery being caught in two minds.
That's not necessarily true, but I mean, 3-5-2.
You're disagreeing with Wenger.
Look, man, Johan Cruyff disagrees with Arsene Wenger, so I'll just leave it at that. No, but
in terms of the pressing.
Yeah. Oh, no. Speaking of Cruyff, actually, though, I would love to see Ozil at Ajax. If Ziyech is going to be, because he is. That's not going to happen. But come on.
I'll move you on quickly.
Absolutely destroy Ajax's wage structure.
I'll move you on quickly.
Imagine that, though. Oh, my God.
We've had enough of Cavani to Atalanta, so we can't be just peddling more pipe dream transfers. We're going to have the first All English Super Cup, and it was Liverpool and it was Chelsea that will meet in that. Plenty discussed throughout the summer in terms of how Premier League clubs are going to build and move forward. But as I said at the beginning of the podcast, there's still more football to come. We've got Nations League, Women's World Cup, Copa America, African Cup of Nations. This week, we're going to deal with the closest tournament coming up. It'll be the Nations League, but first we'll take a little break and then we'll jump in to the prestigious international tournament that you'll all be wanting to watch. So, as mentioned, another chance for football to return home this summer in the Nations League, which, after being introduced, actually was fairly successful. England take on Netherlands in the semi-final, which is actually the second to be played on Thursday, 6th of June. But we're going to start with it first because we have more investment, I guess, in that fixture itself. Gareth Southgate, obviously, looking for his first trophy as England manager. That will be a sight to see. Sarri, Klopp, Southgate, all lifting trophies this summer will be sensational. But one thing I wanted to sort of start with is how much has changed since the World Cup. Obviously, 3rd of June, we're recording here. World Cup was almost a year to this day started. And Kieran Trippier, the Barry Beckham, as I said many times during that summer, set piece delivery, Southgate building a squad around the ability to win set pieces and then let Harry Maguire's massive head cause havoc in the box. We've now completely departed from that. The change to 4-3-3, and Kieran Trippier has not been included in the Nations League squad. And he said himself that was the right choice, the correct choice for Gareth Southgate. So rather than dwelling on the negatives and the changes and the people who have missed out, with another new look England, as always seems to be the case with Southgate, who is this new poster boy of the Nations League squad? Who's someone that's come into the fore and now can make a real claim to be England's sort of key player or the most improved player in Southgate's squad, Sam?
Well, I don't think you can really look past Sterling for being most improved, given he got hammered during the World Cup and his output has gone up a notch. But given he was sort of operating at such a high level before, I'm going to go for someone else, and that is West Ham's Declan Rice. He said recently that he sat in the dressing room after being hooked against Liverpool on the first day of the season, that he didn't think Premier League football was for him. Ooh. And he was maybe even considering a loan move. But he's developed so well since then under Manuel Pellegrini. Excellent composure on the ball, reads the game superbly, dictates the tempo really well from that deep line position. All three of those are so crucial in international football, and England have lacked a standout candidate in that mould.
He's playing next to the one that they should have called up all these years, Mark Noble.
Don't know about that.
That was me trying to be really funny.
Yeah, that was like the podcast equivalent of a hospital pass.
I wasn't sure if you were being serious then, Joe. No, I thought I was going to reel off the Mark Noel debate.
No, don't take anything I say seriously.
But yeah, so in the 4-4-3-3, Rice worked really well, and in a 4-2-3-1, he could work as well. So it gives him lots of options, and the fact that you could maybe make a case for him starting ahead of or alongside Jordan Henderson, I think, shows just how well he's developed.
Well, this is the thing, is Jordan Henderson could be a candidate in himself, because again, at the World Cup was him or Dyer at the base essentially, and even Klopp has moved him forward, or the Klopp Henderson debate about put me forward, boss, I can do it, and then getting those assists in the tail end of the season. And Fabinho now unleashing him for Klopp's side. Declan Rice could be the same for England. Henderson gets to play as a number eight, which we get to see that more technical ability that he has, the crossing ability from that inside right. So Declan Rice's emergence could almost reinvigorate Jordan Henderson's own England career. Obviously now a Champions League winning captain. And he showed it off on that picture of the plane, feet up on the Champions League trophy. But do you agree with Sam's thoughts on Declan Rice there, or do you think there's another candidate that is going to be, as I said, the flagship England player?
Yeah, very valid points on Declan Rice. He's the sort of the Michael Carrick player that we've underrated and sort of not valued enough for so long, and he could be England's redemption in that sense. Trent Alexander-Arnold he sort of made the step up to star status this season, I'd say. Certainly regular starter status. Raheem Sterling, though, a word on, he might not have made such a huge step in terms of Trent Alexander-Arnold's progression, but the way he's developed this season, and it is a sort of sustained continuous development that's taken place over several seasons, and Sam alluded to the criticism he copped at the World Cup last season, and I've spoken before that I don't think it was particularly valid. I think he was instrumental in winning fouls and set pieces, etc. But his rise coinciding with a decline for Harry Kane, obviously for reasons beyond his control, I think, the injuries being one, and the tactical shift into a more withdrawal role, quality for England with his passing this season. But I do think it takes him out of the focus a little bit. And we've said a minute ago when we were reviewing the Champions League final that it is a bit unfair that he's become the sort of the scapegoat reason almost that Spurs won. But regardless of whether you think it's fair or not, it is the situation. He's declined in terms of sort of poster boy status, and Raheem Sterling's rise in that sense means that you could make a case that he's the one who's made the leap forward
and won the football
in relative terms.
Footballer of the year,
that involved in obviously 40 goals in 51 games across the competition season, which is huge for a player who's not an out and out striker.
Huge for a tap in merchant.
Exactly. If only Harry Kane had given him the chance for a tap in that Croatia.
That was in Raheem Sterling's house, the 6-yard box. But again, the 4-3-3 shift that we've spoken about means we get to see more of the Man City Sterling.
Yeah.
Because it's, as you mentioned there in the World Cup, and as I sort of said as well, was win fouls, Raheem. We'll kick it into the channel for you, chase it because you're faster than everyone else, and then tie someone up, and then we'll score from the set piece. But there's no glory in it. Now, as we saw against Spain, Harry Kane drops deep, turn it around the corner. Who have you got either side? Rashford, Raheem, Jadon Sancho. No Hudson-Odoi, obviously. Yeah. Achilles injury. But this is what I mean. Kane's new role is becoming the sort of... And this is sort of a North London thing, and because I'm a fan of Olivier Giroud, I'll just say it straight away.
You can tell Jake's nervous about making a point when he does about six different caveats before actually making it.
No, but rather than being the sort of, as I said, we mentioned Giroud off air about not being the hero because he doesn't score goals. Harry Kane is a better centre forward than Olivier Giroud, no doubts about that. But he starts to play that more sort of selfless role, where he's using his physical strength, hold people off, turn it around the corner, and let your absolutely rapid wingers take all the glory. But he's going to be coming up again against Virgil van Dijk, who he said was one man of the match and perhaps wasn't the best Liverpool defender in the Champions League final. But over the course of the season, there is no doubt that Virgil van Dijk has been the colossus in the Premier League, not just for Liverpool. As everyone knows, 64 games without being dribbled past. Son tried it in the Champions League final. Incredible recovery pace from Van Dijk to get there. And now this is where it starts. The campaign begins. Ballon d'Or being mentioned. Obviously the first player to win PFA Players of the Year, first defender, sorry, since John Terry. Am I right in thinking that Cannavaro was the last
Ballon d'Or winner?
Yeah.
Ballon d'Or centre-back?
2006, yeah.
Guess what's coming? World Cup that summer, Nations League this summer. Will a Netherlands victory, Mo, propel Van Dijk into pole position? Or is it that man, Lionel Messi, that Van Dijk himself said that his favourite?
I mean, first things first is the Ballon d'Or is nonsense. It's an individual award in a team sport. It doesn't really make any sense.
Okay, next question.
No point dwelling then, isn't there?
But I do think if he wins, I mean, he's already going to be in the conversation. People say, should he be in there? Purely off the back of Liverpool's 97 points, least goals conceded in the Premier League, 21-20.
Joint with Man City.
And then
clean sheets.
Champions League as well. You know, brilliant performance in the final. Didn't concede in the semi-final, second leg, and the final. Crucial clean sheets against Bayern Munich as well. It's not all just Alisson.
Scored against Bayern as well.
Scored against Bayern. Yeah, he's. And then if they win the Nations League, then it's definitely he's. Then I would say almost 100% certain he's going to get on the podium. I think right now he might do, but then like if Griezmann or Mbappe starts next season like a house on fire, when the voting is going on, people will be like, ooh, yeah, they're really good. And, you know, they're brilliant players. Messi being there is probably a given, given how well he was and how he should always be there.
For last season.
Well, whatever. He should always be there, more or less. So you take it as a given he's going to be there. He's been brilliant again this season, amazing in the Champions League, amazing in La Liga. He might even win the Copa America this summer, although probably not, let's be honest. Van Dijk deserves to be in discussion 100%. He's been absolutely sensational, as good as any centre half in the world, I would say, this season. Leadership qualities, technical quality, the moment against Sissoko in the league where he just dared him to score, and then that
to dare is to not do.
Yeah, well, I mean, that encapsulates Van Dijk, right? The fact that that moment of where it's like you're 2v1, you're 1v2 sorry, as a defender, that's your worst nightmare. What do you do, right? Most defenders would have rushed over to Sissoko, tried to tackle him, and then he would have passed it beyond them to Son, probably would have conceded a goal. He stands, he says, go on then. He dares him. Van Dijk bet on himself time and time again, especially against Sissoko, and he won. And Liverpool, Jurgen Klopp bet on Virgil van Dijk this season, and he won. Ronald Koeman is going to bet on Virgil van Dijk in the UEFA Nations League, and I bet you he wins as well.
Oh,
because I just think
my job for me there, Mo.
Van Dijk is amazing, and I think 100% beyond the Ballon d'Or podium. He's not better than Messi, is he? He said it himself, so probably shouldn't win it, but he'll definitely be.
I don't think you can ever, as you said, it's a team sport with different positions, different parts, so you can't ever say a centre back or is better than a forward, or a forward is better than a centre-back.
Unless you were so good that your manager played you in a formation where instead of having a centre-back partnership, you just played one. And you managed to defend that whole space.
And then
could you be a centre-back who's as good as Messi, probably.
And then you dribbled through everyone and then got a through ball on a plate for your defender. Harking back to the sweeper days, the libero, I believe it's called, on Football Manager. Fans of that game. But for the game then itself, Declan Rice stepping in England's midfield, we don't know really who's going to play because it's such a quick turnaround. Yeah. We were just saying again in the little break that maybe the Thursday match is to give people a chance to be back in that squad. Van Dijk said he hadn't slept pretty much all evening. I think he said he got about 30 minutes. So maybe be a bit too tired for the final. But let's assume that everyone's ready, everyone's playing. Kane versus Van Dijk again. Raheem Sterling fresh, obviously, as we mentioned. Trent will probably be, if Kieran Trippier is not in the squad, I think Southgate must be hoping that Trent's there in time.
Yeah.
Because otherwise your right back slot, you'll move Walker there, I guess, and with the movement away from the back three. But anyway, enough explanation of it. What do we think is going to happen? England have beaten Netherlands once in the 21st century, but that was the most recent game. So it's on their side. Sam, start with you. Will it be a Nations League final for Declan Rice's England?
I think it will be. I think England are going to win 2-1 with Jadon Sancho, the standout performer.
Of course.
I think the quality that England have in attack is just going to come good and England will win. I do think both teams are going to be shattered, though, because I think they've both got a contingents who have progressed far in the Champions League and have had long seasons that ended quite late.
Dutch are going to win because they have a better midfield than England, basically. They've got Frankie de Jong, Donny van de Beek. It's just a better midfield than England's. They'll control the game, essentially. And I think Van Dijk will play, De Ligt will play. That's a better centre-half duo than England's as well. The only issue the Dutch are going to face is Memphis going to be clinical? Is Bergwijn going to be clinical? Can they take their chances? Because I think in terms of they'll control the game.
Don't need Bergwijn, you've got Ryan Babel, mate.
Well, I mean, yeah, the Fulham's Ryan Babel.
no longer.
The one who holds the secret.
To beating Van Dijk. Yeah.
Oh, let's start that again. Let's put that back on the graphic.
No, definitely.
Possibly go wrong.
Definitely.
Next week's podcast, Jadon Sancho exposes the one weakness.
Well, I mean, will Sancho be finally... I mean, Van Dijk's going to be tired and guess maybe come over. Will someone finally dribble past him? Who knows?
Guess who plays on the right as well.
Well, exactly. There you go. No, I do. I think the Dutch are going to win. I think they're going to have too much control for England. I think England are a fantastically fantastic side, exciting side, and unleashing Sterling and Rashford is going to be useful for them, I think. But I mean, Kane is going to be
Callum Wilson.
Will Southgate make that call? He didn't do it in the World Cup either. Kane was clearly injured after the quarterfinal after game against Colombia. He was injured the rest of the tournament. He played him all the time, didn't take him off. So again, I don't think Southgate will make the call. Same, Poch didn't make the call. And I think, again, that's going to come back and haunt him. Henderson, how good will he be? How fit will he be? Because energy is his whole thing. If he's not running 100%, how good is he going to be? Jesse Lingard will be useful in midfield if he's fit. But Dele, how much use is he going to be?
I don't think Dele will even start.
There's too many unknowns with England for me. John Stones hasn't really been playing all season. You know, who's the right back? If it's Trent, is Trent going to be fit? Who knows? You know, I think Dutch, Bayern and Van Dijk are basically good to go. They've got De Ligt is too good. De Jong, Van de Beek, they're too good, man. They've got too many good players. I think as long as they can take their chances, the Dutch will win maybe 2-1, 1-0, something like that.
One thing actually on that, considering how much was made of the gap in competitive minutes between Champions League final and the last game of the Premier League season, could play in England's favour having so many players in that final.
If you think about it,
the Netherlands have got Gino Wijnaldum as well,
who was rubbish in the final.
So. But he's usually very good though, isn't he, for the Netherlands as well? So I think he'll have a point to prove as well, because he wasn't very good. He was very bad in the final, I think, and it was taking him off was one of the reasons why Liverpool won.
Yeah.
I thought because they actually injected a bit more oomph to the. I mean, Milner was very good when he came on, so I think. I agree that there could be maybe a degree of
rhythm.
Yeah. But Liverpool, the Dutch, are very much a system club. Like the system nation, they're playing in that classic Ajax sort of way, which is going to help them overcome fatigue issues, because it's like they know exactly how to play at Liverpool.
Yeah, but it's match fitness is different.
No, I know, but I mean it's part of rust is. I mean they might have a ropey first 10 minutes, but I think they'll settle into their rhythm a lot better than maybe England will, who have a lot of key players who are literally not just exhausted physically but mentally, going from winning the Champions, winning a major trophy, Champions League like that, to then go and try and win another thing less than a week later. I can't imagine that's very easy.
But then you think about the actual turnaround. Saturday to Thursday is longer than you'd get if you were doing Champions League.
I think it's the turnaround between the parade and the party, really.
That was going to be my...
They looked a bit sloshed, didn't they? And rightly so.
Well, at least Jürgen Klopp's not playing.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, if Klopp was playing, they'd be in real trouble. Because
be screwed.
That dude, I mean, you know, that dude had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And you know
deservedly
what?
Deservedly so.
Yeah, he earned it. Well done to him, Jürgen.
Moving on to potential opponents. If anyone wants to know, I actually think England will win, because despite Netherlands controlling the game, I'm developing this theory and I haven't had the time to actually sit down, but all of the big games are being winning by the team that have less possession. So I think England's counter-attacking potential now with the 4-3-3, Kane elbowing people, spinning it around to the Jadon Sancho show.
That does appear to be the trend of football overall.
Exactly.
But I mean,
see you later, Netherlands.
I'm back in control as always.
It is coming home. but even if they do beat Netherlands, then they face either Portugal or Switzerland in the final, which again is quite nice. Two different teams again. Obviously France World Cup winners are not there, too busy beating Bolivia. Antoine Griezmann with a little reminder of, if someone can sign him this season, they probably
he is available.
He's pretty good,
but the Portugal-Switzerland game in itself is unknown. Portugal, in their last four games they've played, and again, international football, it's so hard to actually get any sort of conclusions from games because it's so spread out or whatever, but in the last four games, all draws, 2-0-0s, 2-1-1s. Mm. So despite having one of the squads on paper that is potentially most exciting, especially with the introduction of the likes of João Félix in the side, they come up against a Switzerland team who notoriously always good in European qualifying and topping groups ahead of more famous names, if you will. And they themselves, alongside England, have seven players aged 23 and under in the squad, which is the joint most out of these four. So despite talking about the likes of De Ligt and De Jong perhaps being the top echelon of young players, in terms of the amount of young players they have in the squad, Switzerland and England have the most. So, Portugal-Switzerland, the game itself, we're going to talk about that going, but who do you feel like out of these Nations League semi-finalists have the brightest talent? So we'll start with Portugal and their chances against Switzerland, because as I mentioned, João Félix, Bruno Fernandes coming into the team, but they usually play a little 4-4-2 and obviously it's all geared towards main man Ronaldo. So do you think they will get past Switzerland, Mo, in this game?
I think they will. I think they're a better squad than Switzerland, aren't they? I'm a better team than Switzerland. I mean, Switzerland did very well to get this far, kind of shook up everyone when they beat Belgium. It was like, wait, what? Huh? Excuse me? But I think now you look at Portugal, they've got a very solid defence. They've got Pepe and either Ruben Dias or José Font. I don't know which one they'll start next to him, but either way, it's a fantastic defensive partnership. You know, the defence midfield is obviously very solid with William Carvalho. Had a good season. And then, yeah, out wide and up front is where they got the game changers, right? They got Guedes. Gonçalo Guedes had a very good end, strong end to the season with Valencia. Won the Copa del Rey, obviously. Bernardo Silva is just, I mean, he's a miracle. He's a gift to watch, isn't he? Wonderful. They've not got Andre Silva anymore, but they're bringing Cristiano Ronaldo back in, and he's pretty good at scoring goals. And then João Félix, who's a total X factor. Where will they start him? Will they start him wide? Will they start him up front? I mean, who knows? They can do either. He'll be again. I don't think he'll start. I think they'll use him off the bench, kind of like how they used Ruben. Renato Sanchez, sorry, in the Euros. I think they'll just bring one to change.
Thought
you
were going to mention Eder then.
No. Well, I mean, I would hope João Félix is a bit better than Eder. And we can't forget they've got Wolves boys. They've got Diogo Jota and Ruben Neves, João Moutinho.
Yep.
I don't think any of them will play necessarily. Or maybe Ruben Neves will play if they want some control.
Well, this is the thing with Portugal. They've been wrestling with identity of what football to play. I think the favourite of Fernando Santos is a 4-4-2. But that usually means in centre midfield he plays William Carvalho and Danilo Pereira, are very sort of... You're not going to get past.
Yeah, he's mentality. He's a very sort of... You saw it when the way they won the Euros.
Exactly.
I mean, their best player was Pepe, in all honesty, that tournament. It's a very solid 4-4-2. You're not going to beat us. I mean, we might just about beat you, if we can create a goal with our superstar forward. So I don't necessarily think that... He may get Moutinho for experience, but I don't know, because like you said, he prefers the muscle, you know. But Portugal have got the capacity to expand to a really, really fun and fun 4-3-3 kind of football. You know, they can really, really be good to watch. I don't know if they will necessarily be fun to watch. They'll create fun moments because they've got so many talented players.
Yeah,
and I think he has enough game changing options in attack now that they'll beat Switzerland. I think definitely, and there'll be stern opposition for. I mean, the Dutch or the English, whoever's in the final. Yeah. I think the Dutch, but there'll be stern opposition. I think in the final as well. But I don't think
resolute.
I don't think the winner is coming from this side. This match, put it that way. I think the winner will come from the other game.
Because also as well, we're talking about fullbacks. They've got João Cancelo, who's constantly mentioned as being one of the underrated fullbacks, especially in terms of his propensity to attack. And when you've got that base of that Portuguese midfield,
he's really
a danger.
He's really come on since he joined Juventus. Like he reminds if you ever watched Maicon back in the day, he's very much like Maicon, tall, broad-shouldered, and very fast and very good at just driving forward. No, it's not necessarily like a Dani Alves kind of creative genius, like Trent Alexander-Arnold is in that kind of mold of Dani Alves. He's more like Maicon, just a bullet train, just charging up and down the flank.
And they've got Rafael Guerreiro on left back as well, with technical quality, and obviously can quite easily play number 10 as he can left back.
Yeah.
So they look to have that solid base and then unleash their sort of inside wingers cutting inside. But obviously up against Switzerland's side, who, as I mentioned, have got one of the youngest squads in terms of under-23 players. Granit Xhaka as captain, who's obviously much maligned, not a fantastic performance in the Europa League final. But then they've got Manuel Akanji at centre-back, who had a good season for Dortmund. Another young defender that will be focused on a lot. One player I wanted to highlight from Switzerland's squad was Kevin Mbabu, who is, again, guess what? He's a full-back, right-back, really exciting. 24 years old, so doesn't fit in that bracket of a young player necessarily. But watch out for him, again, just someone that will always go forward but has the technical quality now to actually make a difference as if he were a winger. Is there anyone from these squads, Sam, that make you think that Portugal or Switzerland have the best crop of young players, or do you think England and Netherlands easily take that crown?
Yeah, I'd say England and Netherlands take that crown. England are the only ones who are going to have a team in the under-21s tournament this summer as well, which sort of suggests that they've got more coming through beyond their senior setup.
No one in the under-20 World Cup, though. So, depends which.
How far back you want to take it?
Yeah, exactly. No under-12 seven-a-side team playing for England this summer. Portugal, again, it's just a generational thing, isn't it? They do actually have the under-20 side at the moment. It includes Jota. Diego Dalot from Man United and Ruben Vinagre, who... under the radar season for Wolves at left back, and I've seen his name crop up a few times in teams of people looking in. So Portugal, good base. As Mo said there, they're almost suffering from that Deschamps France conundrum of such an exciting pool of talent, but does that win you matches, especially at international football? Will, any thoughts on that, or do you want to go straight into your prediction for Portugal, Switzerland?
No.
No?
Yeah.
None at all. Do you have a prediction for Portugal, Switzerland?
I just think that Portugal are the better team and therefore they'll win. Beyond that, I mean, I can't really offer
that
much
is what
more.
Subscribers to the Scorker Talker podcast look forward to.
I mean, Switzerland shocked everyone by getting here. That's the thing, isn't it? No one expected them to get past Belgium. They shouldn't have got past Belgium. Mm. They thrashed them in the end with 5-2, I think it was.
Yeah, Haris Seferovic.
The one thing I would say that actually, though, is in terms of incentive, Portugal, beyond being on home soil, would probably be the least devastated to miss out on this trophy. Switzerland is the first on the international front, and they are rank underdogs, you'd have to say. So you might have a highly motivated Switzerland, but like I say, I mean, Portugal are the home team, that bears its own advantages.
That didn't work in 2004, though, did it? So
yeah,
there you go.
Okay, well, allow me to revise my vision based on what happened 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Is it 15 years? Oh, my God, I'm so old.
19 minus 4 is 15.
So do you think it would mean the most to Switzerland? Or do you think it
actually. Well, to go over the other two teams, England, I think it would underline the progress that they've made under Gareth Southgate. And it'd be nice to sort of have a little trophy that wraps up in a nice bow. But I mean, they got to the semi-finals last year. That's a high in itself, an achievement in itself. I think the team that would mean the most to is the Netherlands. It consolidates the success not only of their national team recently, but of Ajax this season too, in the Champions League. It's a nice little sort of bonus after that. But most importantly, it means they'll have qualified for the first major tournament since Louis van Gaal was in charge.
You know, and we
takes
get
the pressure off the group stage, the qualifiers campaign. Mm. I mean,
and we
all
get
the
to
other
see
teams
Memphis.
Were at the World Cup.
We get to see Memphis celebrate as well, which, I mean, come on. Who doesn't want to see Memphis Depay celebrate a trophy?
Well, he's planning to do a tour and an album. So we need a UEFA. Imagine him rocking the UEFA Nations League medal around his neck whilst doing that tour.
That would
mean most to him.
This is what I'm saying, man.
Quick word on Memphis, though. Like, again, we sort of you did mention him saying that if he turns up and is clinical, he's one of the most exciting players to watch in this Netherlands side in that sort of, again, not false nine role, but seeing him play central, flanked by two wingers, you get to see the complete catalogue of all his ability. And someone that was the most creative player for Lyon in Ligue 1. Always rumoured with a move because of his previous quotes, but it does reaffirm his desire to stay at Lyon as well. If he puts in a nice performance in the Nations League in Portugal, you might be getting some people inquiring as to how much, because he's still relatively so young, moved to Man United at such an early age, didn't go well, but I think he sort of carries that I need to prove people that I am good, and he is very good, and he could be leading Netherlands to UEFA Nations League glory. However, that is all we have time for this week. We will see the winners by the next time we're recording, won't we? Because the final was on Sunday.
Yep.
So we'll be looking at that. The Women's World Cup, as I said, kicks off. We're going to be looking to do some more coverage on that. Look at the stats. Optu have given us access to Women's World Cup data, so that'll be on the way. But thank you to my guests for joining me, Mo. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for hosting, Jake.
Thank you for stealing my intro.
That's quite all right.
Will, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, you're welcome. Enjoy. You're welcome for not stealing your intro as well.
That's fine. Sam, thank you again, as
Cheers,
always. Squawker Talker listeners, please rate, review, subscribe. Thank you to the listeners' questions as well that we had in adding to a brilliant episode. And we'll catch you next week.